This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're going to talk about America's opioid epidemic. Across the country, deaths and overdoses attributed to narcotic analgesics and pharmaceuticals such as hydrocodone, oxycodone, codeine, and fentanyl are up. Heroin, once an exotic and expensive drug, is now widely available and as cheap as $5 a hit by most accounts. Politicians, law enforcement, the medical community, and of course the media can't get enough of the topic. But what is the reality of the crisis? What are its causes and what are its effects on chronic pain patients? And what policies can make things better for doctors, patients, and law enforcement? To answer these questions, I'm joined today by my Reason colleague, Zach Weismuller, a video producer, and Jacob Solom, a senior editor who was a finalist for a National Magazine Award for a 1997 article, a cover story in Reason that was about the government cracking down on doctors prescribing pain pills. Just a few months ago, Jacob essentially updated that story for Reason in another cover story. He also appears in Zach's newest documentary, which follows the travails of Forrest Tennant, a septuagenarian doctor in California who is retiring after being hassled for years by the DEA and other government agencies for treating pain patients in good faith. Jacob appears in the video, which takes place at the crossroads of excruciating chronic pain and benighted drug policy. Jacob, Zach, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Jacob, let's start, if you could. Can you sketch, when we hear conversations or discussions, stories about the opioid epidemic, what are we talking about?
Well, currently what we're talking about is mainly people who are becoming addicted to heroin and illicitly produced fentanyl and sometimes dying as a result of using them, typically in combination with other drugs. The vast majority of opioid-related deaths nowadays are involve heroin or fentanyl or fentanyl analogs.
And fentanyl is essentially a super powerful version of heroin, right?
It's an opioid that is, I mean, the estimates vary, but something like 40 or 50 times as potent as heroin. So it has obvious appeal to black market dealers because you can squeeze a lot more doses into a smaller volume. It is relatively cheap to produce illicitly. Mm-hmm. You can either substitute it entirely for heroin or use it. I think the original use for it was to fortify heroin that had been diluted through the chain of distribution. So that's especially dangerous because you're buying what you think is heroin, and it turns out that it is spiked with a more potent drug, and it makes what is already an unpredictable substance even more unpredictable. So that contributes to opioid-related deaths when people are getting something much stronger than what they're expecting, and they take their usual dose, and it's too much. And then more recently, fentanyl has been used to entirely replace heroin. So you may still be told that it's heroin, but in fact, there's no heroin in it at all, and it's entirely fentanyl. And obviously, that can create problems if you're going back and forth between something that actually is heroin or partly heroin and something that's entirely fentanyl. Then the potency is even harder to predict.
And I mean, some heroin reduces your body's functioning, your heartbeat, and things like that. So if you take too much, or you think you're taking heroin, but you're taking fentanyl, basically you die because your body stops functioning.
Well, it suppresses respiration. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the most dangerous effect in terms of overdoses. And what is typically happening is not only you're taking this opioid, which might be heroin, might be fentanyl, might be a combination, might even be one of these fentanyl analogs that's even more powerful than fentanyl. You're typically, the people who die are taking those drugs in combination with other drugs, often other depressants. So if you take one substance that already is suppressing respiration along with alcohol, let's say, or benzodiazepines, that makes it even more dangerous. And that across the board, it seems to be the case that typically people, when they have a so-called overdose, an opioid overdose, is actually a mixture of drugs that's killing them.
And I remember when the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman died a few years ago, you wrote about that. you know, the media almost always zeroes in immediately on heroin or OxyContin or oxycodone or one or two substances. But in fact, when people die from overdoses, it's extremely rare that it's just one thing. It's like a cocktail of things that are leading in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, Hoffman had taken like half a dozen different drugs. And in fact, the official cause of death was, I think they called it mixed drug intoxication, as opposed to a heroin overdose. But people remember it as a heroin overdose. So that is misleading. New York City has some of the best data on causes of death with deaths involving drugs. And they find that 97% of what are called drug overdose deaths actually involve combinations of drugs, more than one substance. It's not clear to the extent to which that's true in other jurisdictions, because methods vary from one place to another in terms of attributing deaths to particular drugs. Sometimes they'll find heroin or what they think is heroin and just say this is a heroin death without even looking to see if there might be other drugs involved. In other cases, they're more careful. So you have a wide variation in rates across jurisdictions, but in the places that keep best track of these things, the vast majority of the deaths attributed to opioids involve a combination of drugs.
Who are the people who die from overdoses? Are they typically longtime chronic users of fentanyl and heroin and other opioids, or are they first time people who, you know, don't know what they're getting into?
Well, I mean, typically, it's one thing. It's not typically, which people need to understand, is patients who were treated for pain legitimately by a doctor who sort of accidentally got hooked. That is what people tend to imagine when people talk about the opioid epidemic or opioid overdoses. It's somebody who had back surgery or a tooth extraction or something like that, and they got some pain pills afterward, they got hooked, and then they end up dead from a heroin overdose, a few months later or a year later.
And that the storyline there is that, like, you know, I hurt my back at work. I go and I get some kind of heavy pain pill. I get hooked to it. My prescription runs out. My doctor won't write anything for me anymore. And so I turn to the black market either for illicitly created drugs or pills, or I end up shooting heroin and I'm dead in a couple of weeks.
Right. Well, that's the story people tell. Now, I don't want to say it never happens. It does happen sometimes in something like that sequence, but that is far from typical. Typically, when you're talking about people who are addicted to opioids and people who die from drug poisoning involving opioids, you're talking about people who have a history of substance abuse. In other words, they're not drug naive. They're not coming to be treated for pain, and this is the first time they've ever encountered a psychoactive substance and they get hooked on it. They have a history of substance abuse typically. They have a history of psychological issues. They're troubled people, which is not surprising when you think about it. But if you look at the larger population of people, bona fide patients who are being treated for pain, the rates of addiction are very low. Something like 1%, maybe less, among acute pain patients. So that's, short-term treatment. And if you look at the longer term for people who are taking opioids to control chronic pain, the rates are somewhat higher, but still pretty modest. Something like 8%, based on a review of studies that rigorously define addiction and try to measure it.
And that does not mean either that they're shooting up, in a back alley somewhere, right? I mean, it means that I'm not minimizing an 8% addiction rate, say, but, that means that they have trouble getting off of a substance they've become dependent on.
It means that they meet certain criteria for, what they call opioid use disorder, which may include using the drug in ways that the doctor did not direct, a psychological attachment to the effects of the drug, using it in dangerous circumstances, things like this. So some kind of various problems related to the use of the drug. So it's not to say that the use is completely non-medical. They may be continuing to use opioids to treat pain, but they're also using mm-hmm. it to treat, well, psychological pain, let's say.
Right.
So, yes, and it doesn't mean that they end up dead either. I mean, that's, you know, the other thing is that the rates of addiction are low, especially among short-term patients. The rates of overdose are even lower, something like 0.02% annually, based on data from North Carolina. It's a very low rate. I mean, this compares pretty favorably to other pharmaceuticals. So the idea that the typical pain patient faces a significant or substantial danger of dying as a result of taking this pain medication is just simply not true. And it really does a disservice to people who can get safe and effective treatment for their pain, but might be persuaded to reject it because they're afraid of either becoming addicts or dying of an overdose.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, both where the medical industry, for a variety of reasons, including outside pressure, but also within the community, they don't want to prescribe this stuff because they believe the idea that, you know, you take one pain pill and suddenly you've got an addict coming around. Patients don't want to take it, causes many problems. Before, I want to get to Zach in a second. About the doctor-patient relationship that he documents in his really searing, wonderful, I don't want to call it wonderful, incredible documentary. But what is when we're talking about an epidemic, what are the numbers that we're talking about in terms of the number of people who are dying from overdoses, and how does that compare to recent years? I can remember writing about this topic years ago for Time magazine, and there was a few years ago, the Vermont governor devoted his entire State of the State speech to what he said was the opioid epidemic in Vermont. And he was talking about a tripling of overdose deaths, which brought the grand total up to something in the 20s out of a population, you know, 20 something people out of a population of 600,000. How big is the epidemic of overdose, how big is the increase in deaths from opioids over the past few years?
Well, the last few years, there's been a very dramatic increase in deaths involving heroin and especially fentanyl just recently, huge spike. The total number that the CDC estimates is over 40,000 deaths involving opioids, which again, typically involving other drugs as
right.
well. But
that's up from what 10 years ago or 5 years ago.
I mean, there was, for heroin, there was a quadrupling or quintupling, I forget exactly, of the deaths over a short period of time. And fentanyl within a single year skyrocketed. I think it was a doubling within a single year. Mm-hmm. That's like the category of synthetic opioids that includes fentanyl, and we are presuming that the vast majority of those deaths are in fact related to illicit fentanyl, which is a fair assumption. So it's a very big increase, but this is driven almost entirely not by pain pills, but by illicitly produced opioids. And in many cases, you have people who may have started by using pain pills, and then when those pain pills became more expensive and harder to get, switched to these black market drugs, which in fact are much more dangerous. I mean, that's the other thing. If you look at the increase in heroin-related deaths, for example, is much more dramatic than the increase in the number of heroin users, which tells you that heroin's getting more dangerous.
Right.
And the main reason for that seems to be that it's more frequently mixed with fentanyl now, so that the potency is even more variable than it was before. So there's definitely a problem. I mean, yeah. You know, your instinct when you hear about anything the government says about drugs, my rule of thumb is that it's probably bullshit.
Right.
And that's a good rule of thumb, because it's most of the time yeah. it is. But in this case, there is a very clear problem. Involving drug poisoning deaths related to illicit opioids, and the question is, what do you do about that? You know, what are
right.
the best policies for trying to stop people from dying? I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
Let me ask you also, what is the percentage? I'm looking at the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, which is, you know, one of the main data sets for how often Americans over the age of 12 and older use drugs, legal and illegal, including cigarettes, alcohol, and pharmaceuticals, marijuana, coke, you name it. You know, how very few people, and this has always been the case, very few people use heroin on a monthly basis, right? Or one of the questions that is asked for frequency is, have you used this substance in the past 30 days? And it comes back typically under 1%, always under 1%. It's usually, I'm looking for 2016, the most recent year, it's 0.2% of people say that they've used heroin, and it's usually 1/10 or 2/10. For things like opioids, it's a bit it's higher. It's like 1.5%, 1.4%. But that number is not necessarily going up. You were saying it's the use rate is not, the popularity of these drugs is not necessarily increasing. It's the potency and the danger that's really going
up. Well, I think both things are going on. That survey, it is generally assumed, misses a lot of heroin users for at least a couple of reasons. One is that heroin is an especially stigmatized drug and people are less inclined to admit using it. And the other is that it is a household survey, so it does not cover people in prison or people on the streets or people in treatment. We have to assume that it underestimates the total number of heroin users. We don't know by how much,
right. But
the important thing is looking at the growth in not just the rate. The rate, because it's a huge population, it doesn't seem to change very much from year to year. But if you look at the estimates in terms of raw numbers of heroin users, that has gone up. But the increase, as I said before, in heroin users is much smaller than the increase in heroin-related deaths. Regardless of whether it's that survey is capturing all of the users, we assume that the percentage increase is something like the one that's seen in that survey, and which seems to be a fair assumption. But you see that the number of heroin related deaths is increasing much more dramatically, and that's so. So I mean, what's happening here is that, you know, the government has created a black market where drugs are dangerous in general because they're unpredictable. It has made things worse by cracking down on heroin. To the extent that that's successful, it encourages more substitution with fentanyl. So it makes the drugs even more variable, and for that reason, even harder to predict. That the effects even harder to predict. And then they are cracking down on pain pills, which, you know, certainly have their dangers, but at least have a predictable dosage. So people who are using pain pills for non-medical purposes, if they can't get them anymore and they switch to these illegal substitutes, they face much greater risks. So to the extent the government is driving people who used to use pain pills into the black market, it is contributing to this death toll. So it's not a coincidence that as the government is cracking down on pain pills, you see this spike in heroin-related deaths and fentanyl-related deaths. That seems to be largely a result of the government policy, which, you know, It's counterproductive to say the least, to drive people toward more dangerous drugs.
But it also makes a certain amount of sense to crack down on pain pills, if only because, I mean, there's the mistaken thought that, well, pain pills are the root cause of this, and if we get rid of pain pills, downstream effects will be minimized. But also because you know who's giving out the pain pills, right? I mean, doctors. They write prescriptions that are followed, by the both state level and federal level drug enforcement agencies. Zach, let me ask you, a year ago, you did a video, a documentary about Forrest Tennant, this doctor in California, he's in his 70s. He's been practicing medicine for decades. And it was titled "Meet the Doctor Who Refuses to Stop Prescribing Opioids to Pain Patients." It has about 500,000 views because this is like a gripping story. Who is Forrest Tennant and what is his complaint about the crackdown on prescription opioids?
So Forrest Tennant has been running his a clinic out of West Covina, California, just in a little strip mall. It's been there since 1975. And he actually did not start as a pain specialist, but as an addictionologist. So his start was actually getting people off of heroin in the post-Vietnam era. And what began to happen to him was that doctors who were basically couldn't handle these cases of patients that required high doses of opioids, or in some cases were perceived as being addicted or dependent on them, were sending their people to him because nobody else could handle him. He had an expertise. And he came to the conclusion that there were some chronic pain cases that were helped by unusually high doses of opioids. In other cases, he was able to help taper people down. But what happened to him was then the rest of the culture started turning against opioids, and this crackdown from above started happening with the case that Jacob so eloquently laid out about the wrongheaded effort to crack down on pain patients. Everyone started flocking to him. And so after I did that story, he was raided by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And that's where the new documentary kind of picks up.
Why was he raided? Simply because he was prescribing large amounts of pain pills, or because he was outspoken on the subject?
It's hard to say, but he is one of the only doctors in the country who is willing to prescribe above the new CDC guidelines, which cap the recommended amount of opioids per patient. And so that is naturally going to draw some suspicion to you. The warrant alleges that he was taking kickbacks from a pharmaceutical company called Insys, which manufactures a fentanyl medication. His contention is that, yes, he's done some speeches for them. But, you know, however you feel about those sorts of arrangements, they are rather common. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can judge him either way for that. But you can see in the documentary that there are a number of patients who rely on him for basic quality of life issues, and they are terrified about what is going to happen in the future once he begins winding down his clinical practice.
Yes. Could you describe, there's one gentleman in particular who's in his 60s who is, at one point he breaks down in front of the camera. What are his patients saying? What happens to their quality of life when Tennant goes away?
Yeah, so Gary, you're talking about a gentleman named Gary Snook. He's from Montana, and Montana happens to be one of the states that is most restrictive on their prescription guidelines. And, I mentioned that this the cap came from the Centers for Disease Control, and it was supposed to be a recommendation, but lots of states around the country have made that cap a mandatory through state-level legislation. And so doctors in these states are just not going to go above that limit. And even in the states where the cap is not law, doctors don't want to do it because they get on the DEA's radar. So he had gone through just kind of surgery after surgery and multiple levels of treatment to try to treat the back pain he'd experienced after a kind of botched back surgery. And he wasn't finding relief. And so he finally found Dr. Tennant, who is very outspoken about he's a pain patient advocate. He authored the what's called the Pain Patients Bill of Rights here in California, which allows for high levels of opioid pain medication. And so, like many people from around, desperate pain patients from around the country, they found him, And Tennant has described to me that he receives, you know, hundreds of calls a week. His voicemail is just flooded, and he can only take a small percentage of these patients. And so Gary Snook was one of these patients who Tennant was able to take. And he got him to a level where he felt that he could live his life more or less normally. And now the writing is on the wall for him. He knows that once Tennant winds down his practice, he's not going to be able to find a doctor who's going to prescribe that same level of medication to him. So what Tennant is trying to do with these patients now in his final months is humanely taper them down below the CDC level, recognizing the reality of the situation that nobody is going to give them the medicine they need. So we've got to figure out some sort of alternative. And that's obviously causing a lot of angst for people who are worried about, you know, what their future is going to look like.
Jacob, what is there a clear origin story for the idea that it was prescription pain pills that started this cycle of opioid abuse in America? Because it does seem that, and there's some clips in the documentary, people like Chris Christie and others, politicians talking about how, well, you know, the real problem are, you know, prescription painkillers. And, you know, where did that misconception come from? Because you, well, if I'm right, you, even in the story you wrote 21 years ago, there, you know, it was about prescription pills, you know, it seemed to be very considered very dangerous by the medical establishment or law enforcement.
Yes. Well, I mean, there very clearly was a dramatic increase in the prescription of opioid pain medication beginning in the late 90s or so. And around the same time that's happening, you also see a dramatic increase in an increase in non-medical use, and also a an increase in opioid-related deaths involving prescription opioids. So it's not surprising that people came up with this theory. It's a perfectly plausible theory, and clearly the expansion of the market for opioid analgesics has something to do with the increase in non-medical use and also the increase in deaths involving those drugs. If they had not been available, mm-hmm. people would be using different things. They wouldn't be using those things. I think the mistake comes from assuming, well, first of all, that had they not been available, all those people who ran into trouble would not have gotten into trouble. Not at all clear, because if you have troubled people in troubled circumstances, odds are they're going to find something to abuse. And if it's not prescription pain pills, it's going to be something prescription pain pills, it's going to be something else. Could be alcohol, could be illicit drugs. And in fact, what you're seeing now is that these same people who maybe heretofore would have found it easier to get their hands on pain pills are instead going directly to heroin. The percentage of opioid users who actually start with heroin is going up again now. And by the way, I should mention that the typical non-medical user is not getting these pain pills through his own prescription. If you look at survey data, the main sources are other people, and they may be people, family members who have a prescription, they may be acquaintances, they may be swiped from them, they may be given by them, they may be bought on the black market. Occasionally, they're obtained through fraudulent prescriptions.
Right.
But in other words, the main source is not, I got this prescription. And then even if you do have a prescription, it's not clear that it's a legitimate prescription, right? Because you have all these cases where doctors were prescribing drugs to people basically for a fee, you know, seeing 100 people in a day. So mm-hmm. not really seeing them, not really examining them and so forth. So, but you can't call that bona fide medical treatment and say, oh, the, you know, medical treatment is causing addiction. Really, it's addicts getting supply through by fake symptoms.
Well, I was going to say, do you find, how convincing do you find the story, you know, for instance, that the pharmaceutical companies that were, you know, that made the makers of OxyContin and other, powerful drugs with, potential for abuse and addiction or dependency, really started flooding the market heavily, particularly in areas, you know, we always hear about this in Appalachia, you know, West Virginia, things like that. And what they did was that, you know, they created so many pills were there and being marketed so heavily that, you know, kind of there was a spillover effect, and that people who, you know, were just hanging out started taking them because the people who they were prescribed to didn't need them. Or didn't want them. And, you know, they found their way into a black market. And that created a market for these types of drugs, which is now being supplied by heroin and fentanyl.
Well, I think for sure the pharmaceutical companies want to sell as many pain pills as they can. At the same time, there was a legitimate bona fide problem with under-treatment of pain, which still exists, and in fact is being compounded by the current crackdown on pain pills. Those two stories are consistent with each other. That mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have an increase in non-medical use, but you also still have people who are being undertreated. It can happen at the same time. But the other thing to notice about the story you just told, which I think there's a lot of truth to the story, is that where are these pills coming from? Right, they're prescribed to people. And the people don't use them all, right? I mean, this is a very common experience. You get prescribed a certain number of pills after surgery, after an injury. You don't need them all. So what do you do with them? They sit in the medicine cabinet. Maybe somebody takes them. Maybe you give them to somebody, right? But what does that tell you about how appealing these drugs are? If the typical experience is, well, my pain is gone, so I don't need these anymore, they can't be, you know, as addictive as they're reputed to be. And in fact, if you look at the population of people who take these drugs every year, it's a very large number of people. It's like it's close to 100 million people, 98 million.
Wow.
And of those people, and that's medical and non-medical use of pain pills. And you look at that total group of people. Well, how many of them show signs that they have a problem with these drugs? And it is somewhere between 1% and 2%. And that, you know, compares favorably to something like alcohol, for example, where the rate of abuse is much higher. So it's not to say it's not a danger, but we need to put the danger in perspective. And if what you're saying is that people who are prone to abuse these drugs, you know, get them because they're, in a sense, overprescribed, right? There are too many pills more pills than actually ended up being needed to treat pain. What you're also saying is all those people who got those pills did not get addicted to them and mm-hmm. just left them, right? So those two things go together, and you have to, you can't just assume that the person who got the prescription is the one who became addicted, because typically that's not
right.
The case.
And we're going to get to policies that, you know, that might address this problem, because, you know, now we're in the worst of the worst of all possible worlds, where, you know, people are dying from illicit drugs and people who actually need prescription painkillers aren't getting them. Zach, in the documentary, you also you speak to, among other people, Jeffrey Singer, who is a medical doctor based in Arizona. He's a contributor to Reason. Adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, practicing surgeon. And he talks about how during Prohibition, one of the things that happened was that, you know, alcohol was still available in different forms, and that the government eventually started to poison alcohol that was being used for non-drinking purposes in order to prevent people from drinking alcohol because it was poison. How did that work out, and how is that relevant to the kind of establishment response to the opioid epidemic?
Well, the way it worked out is over 10,000 people died, and it did not decrease demand for alcohol on the black market. And what Singer is drawing a parallel to there is the push for what are called abuse deterrent formulations, or ADFs, which is, you know, basically making the pills uncrushable or unable to be liquefied so that they're not so easy to use on the black market. And to one degree, that has been successful because we've seen less pills being diverted or fewer pills being diverted to the black market. On the other hand, there's been an almost one-to-one substitution for heroin on the black market, because, again, it's not pain patients who are using these drugs non-medically by and large. So people want to get their drug of choice one way or another. And what we've seen, and I had a conversation with Jacob about this. There was the governor of Maine, Paul LePage, actually intentionally wanted there's this idea that if you make the black market dangerous enough, people will stay away from it. And, you know, Paul LePage wanted to ban Narcan, which is a nasal spray that you can take to stop an overdose from killing you. And the idea is, you know, we don't want to encourage people to just, you know, get the Narcan and think that it's okay to use heroin. So this entire mindset of if we just crack down on the supply, make it dangerous enough, people won't do it, has just historically not been proven to be correct. And the result has been this increase in deaths.
Jacob, what are the best policies going forward to address, the issue of pain patients being underserved and the black market being made even more dangerous, and hence causing more mayhem and tying up more resources, throughout the healthcare system as well as the legal system?
Well, in terms of pain patients, I think it's important that regulators and law enforcement agencies not judge doctors based purely on the number of people they're treating for pain, the size of the doses, the number, how long the prescriptions last, how long the patients are using opioids. If you do it purely on the numbers, a doctor like Forrest Tennant.
Yes.
A doctor like Forrest Tennant will look like he's obviously breaking the law because he has all of these patients who could not be treated by other, get treatment from other doctors have gravitated to him precisely because he's willing to treat them. So he looks like a bad guy. But then if you look at what he actually does, he's very conscientious. He takes detailed medical histories. He does exams. He requires patients be accompanied by family members who are supportive. And he doesn't see, in a crazy number of patients every day, as you would see in what is better described as a pill mill. So if you look at those kinds of details like those, you can see that he is treating people in good faith. But the tendency is to look and see how many prescriptions they're writing, what's the total quantity of opioids, and if it's above a certain cutoff, they're going to be in trouble one way or another. Either they're going to be investigated, which by itself can be devastating to them as well as their patients, or they may actually end up being criminally charged or maybe sanctioned by regulators or something like that. And then other doctors seeing this happening are going to be even less inclined to treat pain, especially chronic pain. So we have to step back from judging doctors purely on the numbers and ask, are they conscientiously treating these patients in good faith? And if so, there really is no place for the criminal law at all. I mean, I would argue there's no place for the criminal law in any case, but even under the current regime, there should be no place for the criminal law when a doctor is conscientiously trying to treat pain, regardless of the numbers involved.
That's the doctor side. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably the most important. And then, that also requires, the CDC to take a look at its guidelines and revise them or maybe just rescind them because they set these limits, which were supposed to be advisory, but were taken to be mandatory. And the implication was if you go above a certain daily dose, that's not good medical practice. It's not literally what they said, but it is what they implied. And that is what doctors across the country interpreted it to mean. And now they're saying, well, if you've been on this drug for years and at the what is a high level compared to what a neophyte patient would start with, then that's a problem, even though it makes you more productive, not less productive, even though it actually improves your life, even though it makes your pain tolerable. It means you can get out of bed in the morning, you can hold down a job. Even though this medication is clearly making your life better because the CDC said we shouldn't be above this numerical level, we're going to cut you off or we're going to dramatically reduce your dose, which could have disastrous effects and in some cases even leads to suicide.
And if I could just interject for one second, the CDC, there's a question as to whether the CDC should be involved in this at all. The Centers for Disease Control, it's all tied into the problem of labeling this as an epidemic, some sort of communicable disease. The CDC weighing in without necessarily having the right experts on their board is potentially problematic in itself.
And Jacob, yeah. you've written often about the abuse or the expansion and kind of colonization of public health. So the minute that this becomes kind of defined as a public health concern, suddenly everybody, you know, there's a lot more people who have opinions on this.
Yeah, I mean, and the tendency is, I mean, if you call it an epidemic and you try to treat it as such, you're concealing some important points. You know, one is that it's not an epidemic. It's not a disease. It doesn't get transmitted to people against their will. So somebody goes to a doctor and he say fakes symptoms because he wants these drugs for their psychoactive effect. And the doctor gives him those drugs. Well, he got what he wanted. Whereas if somebody in terrible pain goes to a doctor and needs the medication to treat it and he's denied that drug because we're afraid he might become addicted or he's faking it, then he does not get what he wants. And you've imposed this cost on him, not for his own benefit, really, but for the with the general goal in mind of reducing addiction. And that's just, you know, morally unjustifiable. The trade-off there is, in order to stop this one group of people from getting drugs because we don't think they should have them, we're going to prevent these other people who need these drugs in order to have a tolerable life from getting them. That's unacceptable trade-off.
It's a tragedy. What about on the legal side or in the criminal justice? You know, obviously at Reason, we've been around for 50 years. We have written, you know, I'd say about the drug war or about drug policy probably in almost every single issue of the monthly magazine since 1968, if not pretty close, almost daily on the website as well. What's the policy there that would, help stop people from abusing or overdosing? Without also, you know, just giving up on the idea of social order?
There's several promising harm reduction strategies. The one that is most widely accepted is opioid substitution treatments, either buprenorphine or methadone. There's only two accepted substitutes. But there's no reason why somebody who is currently addicted to pain pills could not continue to get those pain pills under a doctor's supervision rather than being pushed into the black market where the risks are much greater. There's no reason in principle. There are a lot of legal barriers to that.
Right.
So that's one option. Another less dramatic change is to allow people to create spaces where you can go and use drugs under supervision. So if you run into trouble, you can get the antidote, you can get naloxone to reverse your overdose, rather than say taking it in the restroom at the public library in the hope that if you overdose somebody might discover you. You know, it's clearly preferable to get help faster. That approach has been tried in other countries, in Canada, for example, for years, and the evidence suggests that it's successful in terms of reducing drug-related deaths and the externalities associated with public drug use. But it has not been legally tried anywhere in the United States yet, so that's a promising option. Making naloxone more widely available, as Zach mentioned, the governor of Maine actually opposed that idea because he thought it was endorsing drug use or encouraging it by making it safer.
County, I live in Butler County, Ohio, and the county sheriff said the same thing, that that's telling people it's okay that police officers or medical, EMTs might carry this to stop somebody from dying, that it's just sending the wrong message. It's a pervasive thought. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is actually, it's a serious argument. I think it's it's a reprehensible argument, but this is the argument goes like this, and it's a general argument in favor of the war on drugs, which is that we're not saving the people who actually end up using drugs. This is not for them. Yeah. And in fact, we're imposing all of these burdens on them, including a dramatically increased risk of dying, because we're saving other people, the people who would have become drug addicts if we didn't have the war on drugs. So that's the argument. And that's, it's very hard to measure, you know, how many people are deterred from even using these drugs and therefore don't become addicted and therefore don't die of overdoses because we have these laws. Those are the people who are supposedly benefiting. We don't even know who those people are, assuming that they do exist, versus the people we can see who are not deterred by the drug laws, who use drugs anyway. And as a result of the fact that these drugs have been made deliberately more dangerous by the government, are dying in droves.
And that's an argument that's deployed against all harm reduction measures that Jacob just mentioned, the safe injection sites, the clean needle exchanges. And it comes from a place, I think, of moral revulsion rather than looking at the data and what effects these programs actually have in terms of addiction rates and disease and overdose.
Well, can I ask you, Zach, you've also done, I mean, you live in California and a lot of your documentaries are based in California, which is a leader in a lot of drug, you know, drug use, as well as, you know, kind of drug policy, especially now that the state has voted to legalize pot, although it certainly wasn't the first state to do that, although it was the first state to do medical marijuana back in 96. For instance, you did a documentary about microdosing, where a bunch of people in Silicon Valley, as well as on Wall Street, use relatively low doses of LSD on a regular basis to kind of clear their head and to improve. It's a performance enhancement regime. What do you think is going on with the drug war? You know, on the one hand, we have this flowering of marijuana legalization, both in terms of medical marijuana, but more importantly, or more far-reachingly, in recreational pot. We have a culture that is embracing psychedelics. Both the medical community is starting to look more seriously again at things like ecstasy or MDMA, as well as LSD and psilocybin, as ways of helping people with post-traumatic stress disorder or just anxiety and other things, pot legalization. And, you know, that seems to be going in one direction that's moving more towards an appreciation for psychoactive substances. And the fact that we are constantly changing our minds literally and figuratively all the time using substances. And then you have something like this going on at the same time. What do you think is going to happen over the next few years regarding the drug war?
I think that, in terms of cannabis and especially, you know, it's just the fact that I think that it's been allowed, that has allowed the information about it to spread, and people have gradually realized that it's not very harmful. And so it kind of just was inevitable that this was going to happen with that particular drug. With psychedelics, it's a slightly different story because scientists did try to study it back in the late 50s and early 60s. And then there was a big backlash with the 60s and psychedelic culture. And now it's just, again, being seriously looked at again with something like opioids, where there is actually a very serious downside to addiction. People are going to have to look at the evidence. That's the only way that I see forward. And when you look at the evidence, you see that it's the harm reduction strategies, and even going so far as thinking about things like decriminalization, that actually make this something that can both exist in our society, but not, you know, tear apart the fabric of it, I guess.
Yeah, and obviously other countries, or most notably Portugal, has decriminalized drug use and has seen positive benefits from that. Jacob, you are old enough to remember the once ubiquitous kind of distinction made between hard drugs and soft drugs. Do you think something like that is going to start popping up again as we, in many ways, America is becoming more grown up about using drugs to change how we feel or to achieve certain goals or to minimize certain harms? Where do you see, and again, this documentary is fantastic and I urge everybody to watch it. your bookend pieces from 1997 and 2018 about the same thing, about pain doctors being put under the microscope for trying in good faith to help people who are suffering intense pain. You know, where do you see the drug war going over the next couple of years?
Well, my fear is that this distinction between soft and hard drugs will be enforced as a matter of law, so that the drugs that are perceived as more dangerous, sometimes correctly perceived as more dangerous, you can overdose on heroin. It's basically impossible to overdose on marijuana, you know, to Right. die of an acute overdose. So in that sense, you know, clearly heroin's more dangerous. I'm afraid that that distinction will be seen as a reason to ban certain drugs, but not others. But the truth is that the more dangerous a drug is, the more you want it to be under some kind of control. And the less you want to enhance those dangers, right? If it's already dangerous, why would you make it even more dangerous?
And when you say you want it under some kind of control, you actually mean that the more dangerous a drug is, the more it should be in the full light of day. I mean, really the more legal it should be.
Right. Exactly. That in other words, the fact that a drug has dangers is not an argument for prohibiting it, because prohibiting it only compounds those dangers by pushing use underground, by making drug quality and purity unpredictable, by stigmatizing, criminalizing people who use these drugs. There were a way for people who want opioids for non-medical use to get them and to get a reliable supply of them. I mean, this is what we're sort of inching toward with, you know, methadone treatment and buprenorphine treatment, but people don't like to pretend it's something else, right? So if you have, you know, heroin by prescription for people who are addicted to heroin, that is going to improve their lives. It's going to reduce the likelihood that they're going to die. You know, other countries have tried that. There's no reason in principle why the U.S. could not try that. In any situation where whether somebody is taking a drug for medical purposes or for non-medical purposes, it is better that the drug be produced in a reliable way and have predictable qualities. And that they be able, if they get into trouble, that they be able to get help readily and not feel that they can't because they're criminals or because it's stigmatized. So prohibition makes use of dangerous drugs even more dangerous. We saw it with alcohol. I mean, alcohol is a pretty dangerous drug compared to marijuana, for example. It is nevertheless legal. If you make it illegal, we don't have to speculate about this because we saw what happened. It becomes more dangerous.
The harm reduction there are two, you know, and this is oversimplifying things, but you know, there are two large arguments for drug legalization that libertarians tend to push. One is, you know, a right of self-ownership. You know, it's my body, I get to put what's in it, and if I fuck up my life, well, that's my problem, not yours, and I'm not costing it on you, you know, etc. But then there's also the harm reduction strategy. Do you think, just as a kind of pragmatic way of either ending or lessening the intensity of the drug war, that one of those arguments is more powerful, or do they need to be kind of asserted in concert with one another?
Well, I think they complement each other, but I think for the general public, the cost-benefit analysis is more persuasive. And right now, look, what people are most concerned about right now is you have this big increase in opioid-related deaths. They're trying to figure out what's going on. How do we reduce those numbers? And if you look at what actually works in doing that, you have to come to terms with the fact that prohibition is making things worse in many ways. And we have to start by trying to reduce the bad effects of prohibition and talk about how can we make it so that these people who are continuing to use drugs, notwithstanding prohibition, can do so in a way that's less likely to kill them. That is the first priority, right? I mean, I think that's what everybody is talking about in one way or another. So this is an opportunity to talk about harm reduction as a way to, you know, make it less likely people will die as a result of drug use, which everybody agrees should be the goal. And we know that the supply side enforcement does not work and that, in fact, it makes things worse. That has been the experience ever since they started cracking down on pain pills. Even deaths involving pain pills have not gone down. They have continued to rise, but very, very dramatically, the deaths involving black market substitutes have gone up very dramatically. So this current approach is not working. And then the response from the DEA and from people like the Attorney General is to say, well, it's not working. We need to do a lot more of it. And then, you know, somehow it'll work.
The beatings will continue until morale improves, right? I mean, this is, well, we will leave it there. I hope, I hope as we become more mature as a nation in terms of, you know, everybody takes a drug, we talk about three felonies a day about how the way that overcriminalization has produced a world in which, you know, everybody's breaking the laws all the time. Maybe we need to rethink that in a way. Over the past 20 or 30 years, people have been taking more pills, more drugs, both legal and illegal, in order to control how they feel and what they can do. This is not a bad thing. Hopefully, we're seeing the fruit of that in the legalization of marijuana and kind of a mainstreaming of the idea that psychoactive substances are not necessarily bad. Hopefully, it will spill over into larger discussions about the drug war. I want to thank my guests, Jacob Sullum, Reason Senior Editor, and Zach Weismuller, a video producer of Reason TV. Check out the documentary that Zach has produced on the war on pain pills and how it's making everything worse. And check out Jacob's story at Reason.com about the same topic, which is a 21 year later sequel. Guys, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.